So we have one more speaker to go this afternoon. We'll have I'll leave a few minutes for questions, I think, after this session, and then we can break for some coffee. Thomas Reardon is with us. He's a professor of international development and agribusiness food industry at Michigan State University, and he's also a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Food Security. Please welcome Thomas Reardon.
Glasses are exactly the wrong range, no matter how I do it. thank you very much. Sorry that I sound like a frog. I just got over a cold, and so I'm a little bit hoarse. My topic today was a very general topic about linking small farmers to markets, especially modern markets. And I realized that in 20 minutes it would be difficult to do that, so as usual, I chose to select my current obsession and passion and talk about that. And what I'm really interested in is the fact that in the 1970s, you had a major initiative of governments to try to include small farmers in markets, and it was called Integrated Rural Development Programs. Billions of dollars were spent in setting up clusters of services of banking services, extension services, fertilizer supply, market outlets for farmers, etc.
Oh, yeah, you can't hear me? Okay. Oh, okay, recording, sorry. So everything I just said was off the record, literally. Okay. But basically, these programs were set up in the 1970s, and essentially they did everything that we're dreaming about doing. Essentially, the government was setting up everything from soup to nuts to be able to include small farmers in markets. And then systematically, these things crumbled and disintegrated and disappeared and were considered, in fact, as they're thought of in terms of their history and their inheritance as a silly idea, a crazy idea that simply fell apart under its own weight. Now, essentially 25 or 30 years later, what I'm observing is a major resurgence of exactly the same approach, but this time fundamentally transformed in ways that you would expect it to be transformed in terms of it being more through the private sector and also public privatized, so that there's now a partnership between the public sector instead of just the public sector and the private sector. So this is like integrated rural development programs phase two that's being rolled out in developing countries in general, but I'm mainly working in India. I spend about half of every year in India, another quarter of the year in Indonesia, and then I show up in the U.S. a little bit and try to share that between Michigan and California. Okay, so I will first start with a brief statement about the IRDP rise and fall in the 1970s, and then talk about this new phase. In the 1970s, these programs were essentially rolled out around the developing world in order to create coordinated clusters of interventions for small farmers in specific areas. These were aimed at, first, of course, thinking downstream of filling the gap of missing market outlets via the introduction of parastatals within those areas, for example, to buy grain, buy coffee, etc. And then second, in order to meet the supply side problems that were absolutely rife within those areas, they rolled out very large coordinated programs to meet the problem of missing rural services, such as credit, health, education, extension, everything imaginable. So it was really quite complete. And at the same time, they studied the particular catchment zones that they were working in and said, we need a highway here, we need a port here, we need trains here, we need the road resurfaced in order to fill the gap of missing rural infrastructure. So missing market outlets, missing rural services, and missing rural infrastructure were all tackled by these programs in particular catchment zones with millions and millions of dollars during the 1970s. Now, immediately, certainly on paper, you would say these goals sound fantastic. In fact, in general, applied across the board either to health or other things, this is exactly what we're talking about at this conference, bringing to bear all those coordinated solutions to bring small farmers into the fold of being able to access markets and not live at a much lower level by being outside the market. Why then did these IRDPs massively fail and were eliminated? First of all, it was widely recognized that government ministries' individual actions often were inefficient, and together they were extremely uncoordinated. So there was a lot of wastage and cost. Second, there was really no market motor attached to these IRDP programs. Okay, so often they were either for the local markets, which were, you know, had a very low effective demand and essentially were not sustainable to grow a demand within, or they were focused on urban markets, but there was no clear link established and no champion that was able to make that link and sustain it. Also, third, obviously, many of the players that were essential in this process were simply eliminated and phased out during the structural adjustment program that came immediately after these in the 1980s. Okay, so these disappeared from view and, in a sense, from memory. But what did not disappear from view were the remaining problems that have persisted to this day. And, in fact, as you're in India and you know this, and I work mainly in Uttar Pradesh and see this every day, massively missing services, basic services available to farmers in terms of credit, fertilizer, insurance, extension, missing infrastructure, certainly terrible infrastructure, and, of course, missing market outlets. So all of those fundamental problems continued unabated, but this public sector solution disappeared. Okay, so then we had kind of lights out during the 1980s when there was mainly the macro adjustment debate, and suddenly now we come to the 1990s and the 2000s to a new era where there's extremely rapid change in the economies of the developing countries that we generally call globalization. And during that time, there's basically rapid market modernization. I would love to talk for much more time on this particular subject because this I'm obsessed with. But several changes were occurring in developing countries incredibly fast. For example, urbanization occurred in those countries 5 to 10 times faster than it occurred in the United States. 5 to 10 times faster. And then there was a massive change in their food system in terms of domestic food market modernization that occurred 5 to 10 times faster than it occurred in the United States or Canada. Rise of modern food industry in the form of supermarkets, in the fast food chains, large processors, also, of course, input supply companies. All of this happened at an unbelievably fast pace, really at the beginning of the 1990s, partly because of liberalization of foreign direct investment and then competitive investment in the domestic. Now, I tend to equate globalization with internal domestic market change because trade is only 4% of the food economy of developing countries. Trade is a very minor issue to developing countries compared to the domestic market changes that are often not part of the central discussion. So I'll tend to focus on that. Now, those you could think of these modern companies, the supermarkets, processors and the fast food chains and other kinds of companies, then as they're rising, they're looking for a supply base. And they become increasingly desperate for a supply base. So you can only economically import for a very short time the supplies that you use as raw materials, and then suddenly you're up against an economic wall, you have to source locally. The first thing you do is you pluck the low-hanging apples, which are the large farmers and medium farmers. Okay, but those are few, usually, in many of the product categories in developing countries. So you immediately come up against a supply constraint, and whether you like it or not, and I'm not talking about this as a, you know, a normative thing, you then turn, you have to turn to the small farmers, which are there in the millions, and you have to source from them in order to get your supply. Whether you like it or don't, it's irrelevant. You have to go to that. Now, what they found is that in order to get to that, for example, they have to go through the mandi system in India. You have to go through the traditional wholesale markets first, because there you are a fledgling company. You go to the traditional wholesale markets, and suddenly you find that's an extremely imperfect instrument to source product from, because it's adding big cost margins because of high waste. There's very little quality differentiation or sorting or grading that's taking place. There's massive storage in India, for example, estimated at 40%, but it could be 25 to 40%. Imagine that, losing 25 to 40% of what you bought. Okay, and then there's no traceability. So if there's a problem, a death of a child, and you can't go back and find out where the product came from. And then there's inconsistent supply, which means it kills any kind of modern plant or processing facility because you need a steady supply. So trying to source all of, you know, to scale up your operation and do it from the wholesale, traditional wholesale markets became more and more of a frustration. So what happened essentially in the early to mid 2000s, in many developing countries, in many companies, both local companies as well as foreign companies in those countries, were initiatives called disintermediation. Basically, that's just an end run around the traditional wholesalers where you try to buy direct from the farmers. Okay, and then you find that the farmers are missing credit, they're missing extension, they're missing fertilizer, so you give them resource providing contracts if you need them. Okay, and so you would say, okay, you're not able to get extension to do vegetable production, which is certainly the case in Uttar Pradesh, we'll have to send a man to you. Okay, because in fact, we need an extension service because you don't know how to produce this. We have to give that to you. Oh, you're not getting any credit because you can't source from the Kisan credit card system, which is actually a problem. Well, in that case, we're going to have to provide you credit because you need to be able to buy these particular inputs to do what we need, et cetera, et cetera. So they end up having to lay on the line a lot of cash and effort as part of the contract with the small farmers in this kind of sourcing situation. Now, what happened is that this was a big dream, and first it was put out as corporate social responsibility. So you see it all over websites. You can always double-click a million times, find this stuff. But my job is often just to talk to these companies and find out that the shit is hitting the fan, as we say. Okay, that basically this disintermediation is very difficult to do and is running into a lot of favors. Into a lot of problems, failures. On one side, they're finding that there's lots of farmers that are signing up for this because it's an attractive price, often lower risk. The farmers love to sell to the modern food companies if they can, okay, in general. But then when they all come, suddenly it's costly to the company to support this effort, essentially replacing missing government services, right? So then they also hit the persistent brick wall there that they say, well, we can't pay for all this. Why don't you just go see the extension agent? And as I hear 1,000 times in India, I'm sorry, there is no extension agent. And if we found an extension agent, we would beat him with sticks because he's coming only for a bribe. Okay. And so you just say, okay, you don't have extension. That's fine. What about fertilizer? How are you doing on that? We can't get a hold of it. So they're running into this massive problem. We don't have a warehouse. We don't have cold storage. We don't have extension. We don't have fertilizer. And you just say, wait a second. How am I going to scale up my operation, use more small farmers? I need you. I don't care whether I like you or not. I need you. But I can't use you because you don't have the services provided by the public sector to do what you need to do to give me the minimal thing I have to do to survive. Okay, so they're in this kind of bind. And so They're also finding that beside missing services and missing infrastructure, now they're dogged by things like policy constraints, such as the APMC in India, where it says that if they wanted to buy directly from the farmer, they can't. They have to go through the commission agent, even if he does nothing, which I see very often. You still have to pay a commission to him, which adds, takes away money from the farmer, takes away money from the consumer, etc. Thus, it's very hard to scale up to include many small farmers right now through this just the immediate cold turkey direct action to buy direct, okay, in this new world. So what I'm observing is an interesting new round of initiatives, which I really think are basically going back to the drawing board on integrated rural development, but this time with a public-privatized form aimed at modern markets as the motors. Okay, so what's happening? I think what's happening, you know, I was just in Delhi on Saturday night at a meeting where this was being discussed with the government, high level, Ministry of Agriculture, the private sector, NGOs, etc., farmers associations. And what really became very clear were that governments in general are increasingly becoming aware that modern food industry companies can be partners for them to be able to get access of small farmers to these markets. These companies can open the doors to modern markets that are very difficult for the farmers to directly open. That's, I'm certain. Secondly, it's often the private sector that can then also be a co-investor, especially in soft infrastructure such as extension services to the farmers. Okay, so the governments are more and more lining up for these kinds of solutions. Also, the private sector that at first was not convinced because they didn't say, why do we need the government? We can just get into this relationship with farmers. Then they begin having these tremendous problems with disintermediation. So they're aware of the pressing need for government to meet a gap in missing services, to create an enabling governance environment of policies, regulation, and transparency, such as regulations facilitating contracts, and protecting farmers and companies, and also promoting farmer companies. And also, the private sector is recognizing the need for collaboration and coordination over private sector segments to meet these needs. Such as, you've got a program here where you're producing something and sourcing, but there's no credit, or there's no insurance, or there's no input market that's functioning in order to provide the base for that. So what the emerging solution that I'm observing are economic hubs or platforms, either physical or virtual, that as a base for clusters or networks of various kinds of actors. And the various actors that you see are basically the food industry companies providing, for example, an output market link, and also public or private service providers in input, credit, insurance, and extension, and then all of that together as a hub or platform to be able to source from local farmers. Now, that sounds exactly like, at least in goals, the IRDP, but it's substantially transformed from the IRDP because it's public privatized, because of the linkages among the governments, but now NGOs is a new partner that were not there in 1970s in these programs, and now the cluster of private sector actors not there in the 1970s. Also, they're aimed at modern market outlets, not usually the goal in the 1970s. And they're also harnessing, and part of the heavy negotiation of these things, the food industry themselves as anchor investors in these platforms, rather than the government as the central anchor investor, apart from some infrastructure. Now, I probably don't have very much time, right? Or maybe even... Oh, my God. The whole time it's been clicking there, clicking away. Like a bomb, you know, in those Schwarzenegger movies. I probably know how to just stick something in there and stop it. But I'll give you a few examples. This is the kind of thing I would rather, because it's more interesting to hear examples, right, than this general stuff. But I'll give you a few examples. For example, the rural business hubs are emerging very rapidly in India, both in a public sector version as well as a private sector version, are essentially, for example, something like rural supermarkets, where a given chain that might start as an input supply chain, like a fertilizer company, would have hundreds, if not thousands, of outlets spread around in a given state. And then what they would do is they would form those maybe over 10 hectares. They would form those into a procurement system base. So they would put in a warehouse, weighing machines in order to welcome farmers in there to be able to bring the product in like ITC does in Chilpaltzagat. And the product then comes in. So they're selling fertilizer. They're selling inputs to these farmers that might be higher quality inputs, et cetera. They're also then procuring. And then they use the base to invite joint ventures, for example, with major banks, ICICI coming in as a bank within the platform, or insurance companies, tractor companies, other equipment and water companies, biogas companies. All of these are then invited in, into, or even cold chain companies brought in as joint ventures on that same platform space, a space that would be difficult for them to get alone. And also the facilitation via the cluster then makes it worthwhile for those companies to start investing in the rural areas. Okay. Then at the same time, they're getting government extension or government help. For example, KVK, government extension to come to speak to the farmers that are coming to bring their product there. So this would be like a private sector version of this. Then there's a public sector version of this where there's large platforms that are built by the government, maybe with the electricity, et cetera, abroad. Then they make a bid, and this is similar to the mega food parks as well, where they would make a bid for a private sector major company, either, let's say, an Indian company or a foreign company, to come in and say, we're setting up a major processing facility here. Okay. Now, what we'll need also are investments from cold chain logistics companies, other kinds of processors that want to start to take advantage of this infrastructure, possibly even input suppliers that will then also locate in this space, credit, insurance, and other facilities that will essentially be attracted by the economies of agglomeration to these sorts of spaces that are being set up. Okay. Now, this is really essentially the platform food park or rural business hub measure that's being taken. And I would say that around the world, this is becoming a very major initiative. There's another version of this, which is essentially the development corridors, which occurred to some extent in the 1990s, but now they're taking on a huge new life of their own. For example, there's the Beta corridor from a port, Beta port in Mozambique, going across southern Africa through sugar zones. For example, there's massive investment of the Brazilians in biofuels in Angola, and there's also mining investments in Zimbabwe, you know, investments, et cetera, in production of various grains. And this corridor or highway corridor will go from the port where there's a substantial investment by an anchor investor, Yara, the biggest fertilizer company in the world, in partnership with the government of Mozambique, who agreed to dredge the harbors, redo the warehouse scheme, and redo the train and highway system. And once they started that as a platform, the World Bank and the Gates Foundation came in and said, we'd like to give $25 million to support spin-offs along that corridor. And now there's kind of a feeding frenzy, for example, equity firms from the Middle East, other kinds of, let's say, processing firms that say, we'd like to locate along the corridor or at the platform. So the idea is that these sorts of platforms set up a low transaction cost, low risk base that attracts a cluster of complementary investments that resolves what seemed like unresolvable problems of dearth of public services that were facing farmers within that local areas and also the inter-segment coordination in those local areas. Now, I'll just end with a statement because he's starting to get his knife out and I can hear it, even the sound of it sharpening, is that these new initiatives are massive centers of interest of the donors and the governments. Billions of dollars are being poured into these things right now. But there's very little revivification of the debate that occurred around these sorts of clustered and coordinated investments, that the debate that occurred in the past, and also asking how can this be made most friendly for the involvement of the communities and the small farmers around these sorts of things, that their win-win sort of participation can be best facilitated by either policy measures or complementary public investments. Thank you.